Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Alaska World Affairs Council. Today we happen to have a bread basket sponsored by Great Harvest Bread Company, and if you haven't had a chance to purchase a raffle ticket, there's still a few minutes to run to the front desk, and we'll be drawing those in a few minutes. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program will be recorded on KSKA. And I'd like to thank William Toyer so very much for doing the recording. You'll be able to listen to this program again on the KSKA website as well as ours. You can go to alaskapublic.org and search for AWAC Presents, and you'll find this program as well as our previous programs. We are a membership organization, so if you haven't had a chance to sign up for memberships to help support the mission and bringing these great speakers to Alaska, please do so. And at this time, we happen to be offering a membership special that if you sign up now, your membership will be good for the rest of our fiscal year, which goes through the end of June, as well as all of next year. So take advantage of this opportunity if you currently are not a member. And we are in the last few days of PFD applications, and if you are filing for your permanent fund, or if you've already done that, you can still go back and designate organizations under PIC, GLIC, and GIVE. Please do consider Alaska World Affairs Council. Our funds through that program go to our endowment fund and are matched 100% up to $2,500 by Cornerstone General Contractors. And so please take advantage of this program and support the World Affairs Council. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council, if you could raise your hand. Do we have any brand new people in the audience? Okay, wonderful, super. Thank you so very much for coming. And if you like this program, please consider coming to our next one, which is going to be on April 12th. There's some flyers at the front where we're featuring John Donvan from ABC's Nightline, who is going to be speaking about autism, a global story. And he will be interviewed by Dr. Thad Woodard, our local celebrity on Line 1, Your Health Connection. So we'll be down in the ballroom for that. Please RSVP. You can check for our upcoming events on our website or our Facebook page, or you can hashtag AKWorld. And if you want to take out your phones and take a picture and tell all your friends what you're doing, that's okay, but please turn them off. And please join our social media. If you're a student, if you could please stand at this moment to be recognized. Do we have any students who have come today? Fantastic. Wonderful. Thank you so very much for coming. I would like to thank BP for sponsoring our student program and making it possible for students to come to these programs. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our partners in the oil and gas series, the Commonwealth North, Institute of the North, Alaska Chamber of Commerce, World Trade Center Alaska, and AEDC, who are committed to bringing these type of issues to Alaska. And I'd also like to thank BP, Shell, and NANA for their support in making this publicity known to folks like you. But most of all, I'd like to thank Northrim Bank, who's committed to education on topics like today's and that are important to our state. Northrim Bank has made this oil and gas series possible. We'd like to thank them very much. Thank you, Northrim Bank. We also have at our front desk some books from our upcoming speakers. So if you want to get a head start and read what they will be talking about and get a little bit of background, one of our speakers in April, Barry Eichengreen, who wrote this book, Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System, as well as The Betrayal of American Prosperity by Clyde Prestowitz. So you can pick those up. Before I introduce a front head table, I'd like to ask Kari to bring up the raffles for the bread basket and see who our lucky winner is today. And Dan, if you'd like to pull the lucky winner. That's it. The winner is 903570. So if you're 903570, anyone? Ah, congratulations. That's Cam from Shell. And before I introduce our head table, I'd like to bring up Chuck Colson, who has a special presentation. Chuck.
Good afternoon. I'm Chuck Colson. I'm the Vice Chairman for the World Affairs Council. I'd like to have Sean Churchfield come up, please. The work of the World Affairs Council is largely volunteer and member-supported, and we're always looking for good people to join us on our board. And Sean has consented to, and I'd like to present you with this certificate, welcoming you to our board for the next 2 years.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Right here.
Congratulations, Sean. And I'd like to introduce our head table and get started with our program. To my far left is Laura Cameron, the chair of our student programs, and WorldQuest, who put on a fabulous program this year that was highly attended, and the students will be traveling to Washington, D.C. next month as part of the national competition, a group of girls from West High School. Thank you, Laura. And Chuck Colson, who you saw come up to the podium, who is the vice chair of our board of directors. And to his right, Mr. Joe Beadle from Northrim Bank, our sponsor, if you could come to the podium and introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Lisa. Joe Beadle, President and CEO of Northrim Bank. I want to make just a couple of comments about the bank and then do the introduction of our featured speaker. So Northrim Bank has invested now about $40,000 in this sponsorship for this special oil and gas series. And many of you know that Northrim Bank, $1.1 billion Alaska Community Business Bank, is publicly traded, SEC compliant. And there's only three such corporations in Alaska that are publicly traded with headquarters here. So we think we're fairly unique in that regard. And as such, our mission is to be Alaska's most trusted financial institution, and our vision is to be the premier bank and employer of choice. And to align ourselves and to engage ourselves, we basically are a pure trade. Our stock is a pure trade in the Alaska economy. And as such, people that own our stock throughout the country like to reflect that we're good management, but we can't be a lot better than the economy. So we care deeply about the economy, and that's why we've sponsored what will become our 10th sponsored speaker to come and address Alaska on these issues affecting oil and gas. While we sit here today, we are hoping as a business community that we get some relief in our taxes charged to our oil and gas industry, and that we remain or become competitive. As we will hear from our speaker today, it is one of those things that they look at. What is the stability and reasonableness of our tax situation? As we talk about the future of Alaska, and as we hear today, natural gas is hopefully an opportunity for Alaska's future. And to do something with that gas and add value, which we'll hear about in the manufacturing sense, you have to have an abundance of it, and it has to be at a very reasonable price. And that price has to include the tax regime. So you know where we stand on all that, just making it clear. Before I do the introduction, I'd like Northrim Bank employees to please raise your hand so that those around your table recognize that we're here to help you. Yep. Thank you. So Daniel Carlson was appointed Shell's General Manager, New Business Development Americas, 2 years ago. In his role, Carlson is responsible for identifying new business opportunities and deployment of gas to chemical technologies in the Americas, including the proposed Appalachia Petrochemical Complex. That'd be great great example. Prior to the appointment, he was general manager, Base Chemicals Americas, leading the team with responsibility for securing advantaged feedstocks. That's the natural gas I'm referring about, mostly locked on the North Slope, for Shell's U.S. Gulf Coast plants. And we're on a coast, and we would like a plant. With more than 30 years experience in the chemicals industry, Carlson has served in both regional and global roles, ranging from business management, strategy development, new business development, product management, supply chain, customer service, and sales. He started his career in Houston, but has also worked in Chicago, London, and Chester, United Kingdom for about 7 years. His principal area of focus has been in support of Base Chemicals and higher olefins and derivative product lines. He holds a Bachelor's of Science degree in Chemical Engineering from South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, is married, and enjoys golf, fishing, Pilates, and photography. And this is interesting. We told Lisa and the Alaska World Affairs Council, if we had speakers, we wanted them to be rock stars. So get this. He's also a founding member of the Dardans, a local Houston rock and roll band. Kudos. Yeah. So Daniel Carlson is here today to speak on this subject and what kind of a game changer petrochemicals could be and are becoming in the United States. Dan, thanks for coming to Alaska.
Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate that. Just a comment about the rock and roll status. As my wife keeps reminding me, don't give up your day job, because she's heard us play before. So, but I did actually was thinking that maybe the title of the talk today ought to be something like Jumpin' Jack Flash, it's natural gas, 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 but our communications people didn't go for that one. So I guess we'll go with what we got. Welcome, everyone, to the Alaska World Affairs Council luncheon. I'm really delighted to be here today to continue the dialogue that you've been having in this series about oil and gas. And today, we're going to actually push the boundary, maybe, of the topic a little bit, and we're going to delve into this world of petrochemicals. So hopefully you'll find this of some interest. I would say, just to start, this is my very first visit to Alaska, so I'm really delighted to be here, and I know I'm going to get out to see some of the area while I'm up here. So that's great, because it was a few years ago my wife set us out on a challenge to go visit all 50 states. She got tired of waiting for me to organize a trip up here, and so last summer she came up here on her own and spent a week touring around and told me how great it was. So anyway, tonight, now that I'm actually here and I get a chance to look around, I think this is going to now qualify as meeting the objective, so I'm one step closer to meeting the goal. Yeah? But what that means, just in case you're curious, contrary to maybe what you've read in the history books, at least in my household, Alaska will now always be known as the 46th state, okay? So you're moving up on the list a little bit. So the title of the talk today is Natural Gas as the 21st Century Economic Game Changer, and the question we're posing is about, could petrochemicals actually help Alaska to up its game? And obviously, the oil and gas space, the whole industry, has been pretty dynamic recently with the emergence of shale gas, particularly in North America that we're seeing right now. And what you need to understand is the fortunes of the petrochemical business are absolutely linked to the oil and gas industry, as you'll find out. So I live kind of right in the middle of all that, as Joe mentioned, leading the project team that's developing this proposed chemical plant up in Pennsylvania. This is a concept that would have been absolutely unimaginable just a few years ago, and it gives you sort of an indication of how fast things are moving and how far they've come. So I've said I've been in chemicals for all of my 35 years at Shell. So I'm not expert. I don't know much about what's going on in the upstream, but I can tell you in the downstream, in the petrochemicals world, you know, it's absolutely turning the industry on its head. And so it's quite an exciting story. In Alaska speak, you could say this is the mother lode of business opportunity. That's the way I would characterize it. So I'm hoping you'll take away two things from today's session. I really want to lay out for you sort of what is this opportunity? What's creating this all this commotion about the opportunity in chemicals? And the second thing I want to talk about is, so with all this investment that's likely to flow into the area, you know, what is it going to take to succeed? And who's going to be successful in being a player in the petrochemical space in the next, in the 21st century? And we can contemplate what the implications of that are for Alaska as you listen to the story. So, I want you to pay careful attention to my disclaimer here. And as you're speed reading through that, I'll summarize it quickly by saying, use judgment and caution when you use the information that I'm about to give you. And in particular, if I make any forward-looking statements about what might or might not happen in the future, you should realize that, in fact, those events might or might not happen. Okay? With that, I think we can proceed. So the story really... Oops, sorry. I said the story is really... you know, all about shale and the fact that this is sort of turning the world on its head. The conventional wisdom of the day had been that natural gas was in a steady state of decline in North America, and that the basic challenge of the future was going to be how are we going to find extra supply to meet the expected growing demand. And, you know, the reality is turning out quite the reverse, and now we're in a situation where people for the first time in generations are talking about the potential for energy independence for North America, which is just, an amazing transformation. So I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this. You've heard stories about how natural gas is developing around the shale play. But what you may not realize is the impact that it's having on big pieces of the industry that are going to be impacted by this. And basically, now we've moved from a situation of thinking we're going to be short to now the question becomes, what's the best way to monetize and use this growing supply, this abundant supply of domestic energy? So there's a lot of good ideas out there being developed and technologies that people are working on to make this happen. LNG, which you'd be very familiar with up in this region, which is liquefying the gas, moving it from remote stranded areas into the marketplace. We think it's about time that natural gas becomes a material fuel for transportation. So obviously, working hard to develop new applications for that, putting in the technologies and infrastructures that can support it. There are technologies that convert gas into liquid products, liquid fuels and lubricants. Shell just started up recently a gas to liquids facility in Qatar that's capable. Basically, this is like a refinery that runs on natural gas, not on crude oil, and it produces, you know, the traditional products you get from a refinery. Shell's got a facility now producing about 260,000 barrels a day of liquids in Qatar. Gas to power, can we find new sources of electricity from clean burning natural gas? And my favorite area down here at the bottom, converting gas into chemicals, which form the building blocks for our modern society. So a lot of good ideas out there on how are we going to actually monetize the gas that's coming. Going the wrong way. So you probably have heard the story, but the whole concept of shale gas development began in the Barnett Shale outside of Fort Worth, Texas, where these engineers figured out you can use these horizontal drilling techniques and hydraulic fracking to allow you to recover gas from the shale deposits which are not economic to recover with conventional drilling methods. And so this is quite an evolution of technology, and literally it started to change the landscape. I'm pretty impressed with the technology. I did get a chance to go out and visit a drilling rig that Shell was operating up in the Marcellus up in Pennsylvania. And I was talking to the driller who was sitting up on the rig controlling the drill bit. And he'd been given a set of coordinates about to where the drilling engineer wanted this drill bit to be placed. Basically, the message was, you know, you're going to drill down about 5,000 feet, and you're going to go out horizontally about 4,000 feet. Here's the coordinates where I want you to end up. And I asked the guy, so how close can you put this drill bit to where he's telling you to put it? And the guy said, about 18 inches. So this is a technology where we're not talking about just putting this thing and finding the reservoir. We're talking about where do you want to put it in there to maximize the production. So the technology is really quite advanced. So now that people figured out how to recover the shale, you look at the map here, and the dark red is the area that represents the shale deposits and the shale basins that we know about in North Dakota. So extremely prolific. These are names that you probably recognize. The Barnett Shale, the Bakken up in North Dakota, the Eagle Ford down in South Texas, and the Marcellus, the big swath you see there that runs through Pennsylvania and West Virginia. So literally the potential for some world-class gas fields as this shale gets to developed. I've got to learn the buttons. So what does all this have to do with the world of chemicals? Well, you may be familiar with the products we make or think you're familiar with them, but you got to realize that a large percentage of those products actually come from oil and gas. And it's a fundamental choice that chemical producers have is, do I want to base my feedstocks on oil or do I want to base my feedstocks on gas products? But then basically the steps are very similar. It's a question of converting the basic building blocks into running them through different processes, improving the functionality of the material, and adding value to these hydrocarbons all the way down these value chains. Now, the chemistry gets pretty complicated if you get down here at the far end of the chain, and I realize that maybe not everybody in the room enjoyed the chemistry that they had in high school, so I won't delve too far into that. But back up here in the area I call base chemicals, you know, it's not very complicated. It's pretty simple, straightforward molecules that are very versatile and are the building blocks that all these other materials get made about. That's where Shell plays in that space now. So we're in the basic chemicals area, making the building blocks. So the markets that we go into, again, these are products that you're going to be familiar with in the automotive sector, in the construction industry, consumer goods, packaging, all kinds of areas like that for the chemicals. Just to give you a sense for who the players are, who gets involved in this business, here's kind of the top 10 list of some of the largest producers, and I show you a split of where the production centers are for the world. And you can see that Asia remains a big production center, as does North America and the Middle East. And it's interesting to note maybe that who these players are. So you see a different cast of characters. You'll see international oil companies are big players in chemicals, like Shell and like Exxon. You also see the more pure play chemical players like BASF, Dow, and DuPont are in this space. And more recently, we're seeing entrances from the national oil companies. So we've got the Saudis, who are now a big player in petrochemicals, as well as the Chinese in Sinopec. So these are the kind of folks that are lining up to figure out how to take advantage of the opportunities that are getting created in the chemical space. So now we get around to the point to say, okay, what does this What does this mean? What's it going to take to be successful in this business? What do these folks look for when they want to make an investment? And as we heard in the introduction, you know, access to feedstocks is sort of job number one. You've got to have an abundant source of economic feedstock to make this work. And the reason is the cost of the raw material and energy comprise over 90% of the total costs of these materials. So if you start off with the wrong the wrong cost for your ingredients, there's no way you're going to compete globally. So that's really key to the whole game. You got to know who your customers are. You got to figure out how you're going to get your product to the marketplace effectively, because a lot of these different materials, transportation issues can be quite challenging. So figure out who your customer is and how you're going to get it to them. And the third area is the stable and predictable competitive investment climate. You're going to talk about very big investments. You're going to talk about big consequences if you get these things wrong. And so you want to know, you know, how do you manage your risks in an investment like this? So I ask myself, you know, who does this well? Who are some of the examples out there that we could maybe learn from to say, you know, who kind of gets it? And learn some lessons and think about how this might move forward from here. Three areas that I picked out: the U.S. Gulf Coast, the Middle East, and China. In the U.S. Gulf Coast, the petrochemical business has been extremely successful. In ethylene, which is one of the basic building block commodity chemicals that's produced in the world, over 95% of all the ethylene that's produced in the United States is produced in Texas or Louisiana. In fact, I think there's 33 of the 36 plants in the United States. You can find them in a little strip of land running along the coast between New Orleans, Louisiana, and Corpus Christi, Texas. So a huge concentration of assets. So why are they there? Well, the Gulf Coast is an absolute crossroads for feedstock. You have onshore and onshore gas and oil production. You've got offshore gas and oil production going on. You have that all flowing together through a pretty good integrated pipeline system with storage. You also have great access to a market. The U.S. petrochemical market's extremely large, and it's well served from people in the Gulf Coast. They can also, you know, easily export product, given the proximity to the coastline. So this is an area that's extremely competitive, and as we've seen recently, with the advent of shale gas, lots of investment flowing in here now, and we have huge, several big announcements about new capacity that will be installed in the Gulf Coast. So we haven't built one of these olefin plants in North America in a dozen years. And I think now you would look at it, I believe there are 6 or 7 new world scale plants that have been announced for that part of the world. So this is, you know, investments on the scale, I suppose, in the order of $40 billion of capital that's going to be flowing into that area if those all get built. Middle East is a bit of a different business model. Middle East had huge hydrocarbon resources that were being developed. As oil was produced, they got stranded gas. Sounds familiar. What are we going to do with the gas? And 30 years ago, made a strategic decision and said, we're going to convert gas into chemicals. And then they said, there's no market for these products in the Middle East, so we're going to design our entire business model to take these products and move them into Asia and into the growing markets. Hugely successful, long-term strategy. They have the lowest cost position in the world for their chemical business, and they've grown from almost nothing to 20% now of the global production of these products is done in the Middle East. Pretty successful business model. China, it would be another example. The difference in China is, there you're talking about a demand center. That's where the growth is, so that's about building capacity near customers where you'll have an advantage about how you move product to your customers. They don't have gas. They produce their products, as you'll see, from chemicals or from oil. But they do have the advantage of that's where the demand is all located. And so they've come in late to the game, but are now, you know, building up their capacity quite quickly. So three different concepts on how you can actually be successful at doing this, each a little bit different. So let's drill down now and take a look at what's happening in this, on this area of production economics. We said that you can choose gas or you can choose oil if you're in the chemical business as your principal feedstock. It's a critical choice. Here I show how crude and natural gas prices have evolved in the U.S. over time. And you can see that historically, the two have been about the same on a heating value basis. But a few years ago, something started to happen. And you saw a big decoupling of the crude and gas price. And a big part of this story is shale. With all the gas coming on, it started to lower the price of gas. And you can see gas prices have actually moved down over the past several years, while the price of crude has gone up. So if I convert all this to a dollar per barrel basis in today's world, where you have crude at just about $100, today natural gas would be worth about $20 to $25 a barrel. So it's just absolutely creates an enormous opportunity space in the middle of that, which is what's happening to the chemicals industry right now. So here's how the production costs in the chemicals business have changed as a result of this decoupling of crude. If you go back, it's a kind of a tale of two different periods. 2007, 5 or 6 years ago, the U.S. industry was in trouble. It had high costs, demand was faltering as the economy was weakening, too much capacity, uncompetitive, couldn't export its products and compete. Fast forward to today, you can see the dramatic shift compared to Europe and compared to North Asia Pacific. Our costs have gone down dramatically as we've moved away from the oil-based feedstocks toward gas-based feedstocks. So what this means in reality is you can now produce petrochemicals in the U.S., you can ship them to China cheaper than they can make them over there, because they're going to be using crude oil-based materials. So it's a huge opportunity space, and this is what gets people excited about, do we really have the opportunity to restore some manufacturing jobs back into the U.S.? This is a manufacturing-based industry, and bringing back jobs here to take advantage of the economics right now. Quite a big story. So I guess the question was, all this opportunity space, what about demand? How is that looking? Are we going to have needs for this product in the future? Will there really be room to make investments? So we went back and took a look historically back to 1980 at the growth rates of some of these key products. And what you see is ethylene, which is sort of our surrogate for the petrochemical business, has been growing faster than oil, gas, and GDP. And so it looks like, you know, there's a pretty good story here that the business is on a nice growth trajectory. But the question I'm sure in everyone's mind is, so where is it going to go from here? Will it continue to grow? Are we going to see changes take place? Actually, we think the prospects are pretty good for continued growth. And the big reason for that is if you look at how the developed world has evolved in its consumption of chemicals, on a per capita basis, you see they're up here at the 80 kilogram sort of level. That encompasses about 1 billion people today on the planet that are consumers like us, and they own cars and refrigerators and TVs. On the other end of the scale, you've got 5.5 billion people that consume a lot less right now nowhere near the same amount. But as these economies are developing, they're spinning off more and more people economically into the new middle class. And they want all the same things that you want, and they're starting to buy them. And that's driving the demand for this on a pretty steady growth path. So I think it really presents a challenge for the chemical industry to continue to meet the growing demand in the future, to find the right sorts of feedstocks, to continue to innovate and make better and better products in order to take advantage of the growth that you see here. So the final area that we talked about that was a key to attracting investment like this competitive and stable investment climate. The first thing I've got kind of listed there, some bullet points of what you might want to think about if you were going to get serious about attracting a chemical business here for the long term. And message one is think long term. These projects are of such a scale that the economics are certainly looked at on a 25 or 30 year sort of time horizon. So this is not something that's going to happen very quickly. You have to think about it in that long-term context. Shell has four of these olefin plants down in the Gulf Coast right now. Most of them were built between, I think, 1975 and 1981. They're all over 30 years old, but I can tell you, the assets are in fine shape, and I expect them to be around for another 30 years. So if you're bringing this industry in to the neighborhood, you're talking about something that everyone hopes is going to be there for a long time. We speak about competitive fiscal policies. This is a global business. You see what you're competing against, Middle East, Asia, other parts of the world. And so all the investors are going to be looking at what's the total cost of doing business in one region versus the other, and how do these things compare? So you can't sort of take an isolated view. You've got to think this is clearly a global business. Strong community support is a key for any project like this. A mega project such as this have enormous impacts in a community, and getting the right level of support right up front is hugely important, that you understand what the issues are, you work with the community, and develop a project together in cooperation. I put something up here called proactive economic development strategy, and this is the idea that get organized. What you find is, as a business developer, I certainly appreciate when you go into an area and you're looking to get something started, having some local help that's basically got a strategy. So has somebody sat down and thought about, do we want this chemical industry here or not? What's the vision for how this is going to play out, and what assistance can you provide in terms of developing it and moving projects forward? Lots of good examples out there of people that do this well. on one extreme, you probably have people like the Singapore Economic Development Board, complete vision for what they want to create in terms of the chemical industry. They're buying land, they're saying this is the kind of units we want over here. It's a very proactive approach to it. We also see good levels of support from organizations like the Greater Houston Partnership up in Pennsylvania. I know we're working with the Allegheny Conference and the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance, who are providing enormous support. So it's really important to be organized and be focused. And the last area is really have the ability to pull off something like this. Project execution is pretty fundamental to something of this scale. The investment levels, are multi-billion dollars. And having, the ability to have skilled labor, have the land, the infrastructure that's necessary to be successful, will be something that everyone would be looking at as they try to understand what the impact of this is going to be. So speaking of sort of the economic impact of this, we have had people take a look at some of the potential. This was a study, this was from a study that was done by some folks up in Pennsylvania looking at what would the impacts of chemical investments be up in that area. And they looked at it in two different phases. The first is during the phase where this facility is going to be built, and then the second is once it's up and running? What's it look like? And they're very, very different worlds. In the construction phase of this, which takes in the order of 3 or 4 years probably to build one of these things, that's when you're seeing the big injections of capital. It's a multi-billion dollar kind of investment. And you could have upwards of 10,000 construction workers on a site actually building one of these things. So you're having an obvious huge economic impact at that time, both on direct jobs plus the indirect labor in the region that's supporting it. Once you move into the operations phase, the direct job totals go down. You're still talking about 400 or 500 high quality jobs in the area directly, and then several thousand which are spring up in the local area to support the ongoing operation that's happening there, as you're going to do maintenance and you need supplies to keep the facility operating. So it is quite an economic impact opportunity, excuse me. And again, this is why I think there's so much interest in some of these areas to bring jobs back into the manufacturing sector. You may be curious of what this kind of looks like to get a sense for the size and scale and scope of what we're talking about. It's some pretty big pieces of equipment. If you're a chemical engineer, you're going to love this. It's a lot of pipes and valves and vessels and reactors, and pretty cool stuff if you're on the engineering side. But what you're going to end up with is not just sort of a single plant. Within this site, you're going to see multiple plants that are together integrated to produce what we're talking about. So you'll be producing your own steam, your own power, utility systems, cracking ethane and converting it into the various chemicals that you decide. Picture on the bottom is the most recent facility, that chemical complex that Shell completed, which was in Singapore on Jurong Island in 2009. I think we started that up. So with shale gas coming and all this opportunity, are all these investments going to end up on the Gulf Coast? That's been the place that the industry has certainly found a home. And there have been a lot of announcements out to go build some more down there. But we actually think, because of the way shale gas is going to develop, there may be some new and different opportunities for people to take advantage of those. Take, for example, what's going on in Appalachia. So 5,000 feet down, you've got what could become one of the world's largest gas fields. And what it happens to be doing is sitting underneath the industrial center of the Northeast US. So on the surface of the ground, we've got customers and demand for chemicals. So the concept there was quite simply, doesn't it make sense to pull the resource out of the ground locally, reinvest locally to produce higher quality chemicals and to sell them to the local customers there? So there's a lot of interest in that concept. It presents new challenges because you're not down in the traditional area in the Gulf Coast where everybody's used to operating. But indeed, seems like a pretty compelling story, and that's what I spend most of my days working on, is trying to figure out whether we can indeed make that happen. Shell's looking at this kind of a project, and there are others that are trying to do the same thing. So I guess the answer is we hope there are other places to get built besides the Gulf Coast. So let me kind of wrap that up and summarize for you. I think the story is pretty clear that this is a big opportunity space. It's really right now being driven by the changes happening in the shale gas sector. Shale gas is bringing two things to the chemicals industry. It's increasing the quantity of feedstock that's available to produce these chemicals, and it's providing it at a lower price. And so it's provided a huge economic incentive to now build up the industry in the US to support these export markets. And the industry's reacting to take advantage of that, and there will be a number of new plants that are built. But again, we think that there may be some opportunities in the way the gas plays are developed that not all of these facilities will necessarily be in the Gulf Coast, but there may be opportunities to put them elsewhere. So I appreciate your attention today, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to give you an overview of what's going on in the chemical business. It's an exciting story. The decade ahead will certainly be one to watch, and thanks again for inviting me today.
Thanks, Dan. We've got a few minutes, and you did say you'd be willing to take a few questions if they come up. I would ask that you wait until a microphone gets to you so the people who are going to be enjoying this on the radio get a chance to hear your question as well. All right, right here.
I wonder if you would comment on the other plastics other than polyethylene that have been on the market for some time and are showing up, for instance, in the framework of firearms. These plastics are actually seem to be taking the place of mild steel. The infantry division I was within in World War II was in Dusseldorf, Germany. And there were samples of plastics that came from their lab that we picked up as souvenirs that were absolutely substitutes for mild steel.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could give us a little on the research that's being done in that area.
Well, this is a technology-driven business, absolutely, and some of the things that they're doing with the materials nowadays is just incredible. And the things that they're making, you're talking body armor being made from, you know, these chemicals. We're talking about, you know, this is the whole emphasis is building stronger and thinner materials that are lighter weight. You do it for things like you're talking about for weapons, but one of the big areas that people are focusing on is making these stronger films that are you can make small, lightweight films. And you can remember the old days, you know, 15, 20 years ago, remember a trash bag, which forever was developing rips and you couldn't carry anything in it. Today, you've got these very thin films, and now they're using these thin films. They'll shrink wrap a pallet full of bricks. I mean, it's just incredible the strength that you can put into these materials in very thin films. So, absolutely, what I've said all along is we need to continue to innovate, and the materials are going to get better and better, and this is going to help to fund the growth of this industry. Great question.
On your chemical complex, your feedstock is it natural gas, or do you convert it as an interim conversion?
Yeah, the things that Shell and some of the other folks that are on my list there were looking at is really based from what we call natural gas liquids. So this comes, certain versions of natural gas will include NGL liquids as well, and what the industry does is strips out the gas liquids. This would be products like ethane and propane and butane. Those are the materials that are really the most suitable for producing chemical compounds. Although you can make some chemicals from methane, I think as you've done here in the ammonia industry and some of the others. But the big volume stuff really comes from, you need to find gas that's got liquids in it as well.
What is the potential for methyl hydrates as a feedstock?
Pass. sorry, I'm I can't answer that question. You've stumped me.
Thank you.
All right.
How close is the industry to getting to be able to produce a super clean, low sulfur diesel from natural gas and be economically competitive with making it from crude oil?
A little outside my area, but I do know that I talked a little bit about the gas-to-liquids technologies, and the nice thing about that is you're dealing with a clean product to start with, so you don't have the sulfur compounds in it. And a lot of the diesels that are being produced from these GTL facilities are very, very low in sulfur compounds.
As you were talking about long-term planning, I was getting all excited about it. But when I was living in Houston, I heard a lot about the bad air pollution around the petrochemical facilities in that area. And I never experienced it myself, but driving through New Jersey or Pennsylvania, I did. So what does a community have to be aware of in planning a location for something like a petrochemical plant?
Yeah, I think one of the things I meant to mention it, obviously, being able to navigate the regulatory landscape is hugely important to getting a project like this off and running. So most of what you're going to be dealing with is water issues and air issues as it relates to these operations. And so this is largely the air quality issues are regulated under now by the EPA under the Clean Air Act, and they're administered at the state level. So it's really going through a process of making sure that it's clear what the requirements are, getting the regulations or getting the information that's required to file your permits on time, and getting all that in place. It's a very complicated issue. It's something that we have, you know, I think is usually on the critical path for any of these projects, is making sure that you've got approval from the state and from the EPA on the air permits that you're going to be operating. And those regulations can, you know, that are, again, not set by the industry, they're set by the state and the federal level. That gives you your license to operate.
I'm over here. Thank you very much for a very polished and, if I may say so, complex presentation. It was terrific. I'm sure a lot of people in this room have just one question in their mind, which is, are there any implications of this for us here in Alaska? And I have a sort of a second question that goes with that. We have a very peculiar economy, as you may have noticed here, where there's very little taxation, and we depend on particularly oil for extraction taxes and royalties and so on. So in this strange economy, if you bring in a new person, you know, new jobs don't necessarily generate the public revenue that's required to support that new job. So given those, I know that's kind of elaborate, but I wonder if you'd want to comment on the Alaska situation from your perspective.
I've now been here for 12 hours in Alaska, so I probably need to be a little, though, but on, seriously, I think, you know, my intention today is literally to lay out sort of what the framework might look like, and I think it has to be the beginning of a long dialogue amongst yourselves, amongst the community, amongst the government, is this the right kind of thing? Is there a reason to pursue this? Is this a good fit for you? You know, obviously, what you heard earlier was until you get access to, you know, start to increase the production of the gas and have it available at the right economics, this is all kind of an academic conversation. But I think if you want to think strategically, hopefully I've given you some ideas about here's what it would take, here's kind of what the implications could be. But the next step is really to say, you know, is that anything that a place like Alaska would even aspire to? This is what, you know, similar to the conversations that we've had with the administrations up in Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia. They weren't thinking about chemical industries, you know, 10 years ago. And they've had to kind of play catch up and say, gee, the landscape is changing. Let's try to understand what this means for us and put together a coherent strategy for how we want to take advantage of it. And I think to some extent, you know, you're much not as far along as that process just because of where we are on the developing the resource base. But you do have time, and I think would be served well to consider some of these options for the long run. But again, I don't think you've missed an opportunity yet. I think this is a conversation that can extend out into the future.
Hi. I too thought it was a great presentation. When you showed the decoupling of gas and oil prices, basically how long out in the futures market can chemical companies secure that low price gas contracts?
Not far enough. Yeah, no, it's really, I don't think, a viable strategy to secure or to offset the risk of a multi-billion-dollar investment. So I think what you're seeing is these companies really are voting with their pocketbook by saying we're going to build these plants because they do believe that there's enough resource that's readily developable in North America to sustain that differential for an extended period of time. But then again, I mean, I'll caution you, the chemical industry has historically been very cyclical, and anytime you create opportunities in one area, you're creating, you know, arbitrage space, and you're going to see people react in different ways. So I don't expect that'll change. The technologies of shale are certainly transportable across borders, and other areas of the world may well start to develop these ideas as well. So I think the opportunity is here today. We'll see how that will play out.
Thank you, Dan, for a very interesting presentation, very thought-provoking, too, given the size of the gas resource we have here in Alaska. I'd like, on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'd like to present you with a gift.
Very much.
Thank you for coming up, and hopefully you'll come back to Alaska again as a whole family. I've been asked to remind you again that the World Affairs Council is member-supported, and there are cards on your table that you can take the opportunity to fill out and join so we can have more great speakers like we had today. And speaking of speakers, our next speaker is on April 12th. When John Donvan will speak on autism, the global story. He's going to be interviewed by Dr. Thad Woodard here. It'll be here at the Hilton. Please sign up for that and any of our future events as well. It helps us with numbers planning, so I do appreciate it. There's more information on our future speakers up at the front desk, and thank you for coming today.